Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. We are grateful to podcaster and activist Dave Gehary, who just this week completed a long live interview with National Alliance Chairman William White Williams, part of which we'll be presenting to you today. You will notice a change in audio quality after the interview's first few minutes, but pay it no mind. The interview was recorded in two parts using two different microphones. That's all. What you will hear now is a fascinating chronicle of a man's life, the radical changes he's seen in our society since his childhood in the early 1950s, his education on racial and political realities under the mentorship of some of the best thinkers and philosophers of our time, and how he has chosen to work for his people instead of his pocketbook. Listen.
Welcome, folks. This is Dave Gehary, and you're listening to the Dave Gehary Call-In Show on speakfreeradio.com. We have a great guest today, a great man, Will Williams, who heads the National Alliance, and we're going to get right into the show right now. And welcome, Will. Let the listeners know a little bit about yourself, as much or as little you want to, from starting from the beginning, when you were born, where you were born, and leading up to how you became involved in this quote-unquote movement.
I was born in 1947, before baseball was integrated, before Israel became that shitty little nation it is. And I was born in Granville County, North Carolina, just north of Raleigh. It was a small town, but a nice place to be born. Both sets of grandparents were in Oxford and worshipped at the Oxford Presbyterian Church with my aunts and uncles and cousins, and it was a white world. James Webb was from Granville County, the Webb Telescope. So he was a favorite son. We moved to Raleigh, the capital, about 40 miles away when I was five. And they were building the Josephus Daniel Jr. High School across the street from the apartment we were in. And Josephus Daniels was, he owned and ran the News and Observer newspaper, the newspaper of the state. It was Democrat back then, and he had been Secretary of the Navy in the 20s and Ambassador to Mexico under FDR in the 30s, and so that was an honor to be living across from this new school. But after the George Floyd crap 3 years ago, or whenever it was, they found out that Josephus Daniels was a racist. So they had to change the name of the school. He had the biggest house in town, and they've since torn it down because he was a racist. And
that was nice of him.
Yeah, it's crazy. Cameron Village was the largest shopping center between Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, built in the early 50s. And they had to change the name of that, too, because they found out the Cameron family, who had donated the land, were racist. So, anyway, I got out of Raleigh soon enough. I'm up here in the mountains now, where we don't have that problem of changing school names yet or anything like that. I went to all-white schools in Raleigh. Never had a black in our schools until, I think, my second year in high school. They put, let's see, that would have been 63 or something like that, the civil rights movement. And but we had never had the blacks in our school, no teachers, no K cafeteria workers, no janitors, anything. It was a segregated white world and a nice place to grow up. Of course, that's all changed now, like changing the name of a school. So I've been up here in the mountains for the last 32 years. When I graduated from high school, I joined the Army while I was 18, still in high school. I remember reading George Lincoln Rockwell's interview in Playboy magazine, I think it was April of 1966, and it had a profound effect on me. I said, how in the world can this man say the things he's saying? Because we just didn't hear that kind of talk about race and Jews and such. But anyway, 4 years in the Army, and I just did my soldierly duties. And when I got out, went to North Carolina State University there in my hometown, Raleigh. I was, 23-year-old freshman. Had spent two tours in Vietnam and had enough of that. The campuses were tumultuous in the early 70s, kind of like they're becoming now with these protests against Israeli occupation of Palestine, Gaza. So it was a little more violent back then, and it was the anti-war movement was front and center, but it was a chance for the counterculture led by Jews. The queer movement, the feminist movement, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll just tearing down traditional values of the formerly white America, and civil rights, they kicked in big time then. And, well, things haven't really been the same since. I always enjoyed building, so I wanted to be a builder, but I had to start off at the bottom. I was an office boy in an architect's office, sharpening pencils and emptying waste baskets and, making about 2 1/4 an hour. And it was a few steps down from being a Green Beret captain. But anyway, I had to pay my dues, and I eventually learned how to draw plans, and we had clients come in. We'd design their houses, and I got to where I wanted to build. So I started a framing crew, or worked on a framing crew, and then I had my own house framing crew, and because I could read plans. And from there, I worked for a number of trim carpenters and, just learned how to build houses. Worked for an excellent custom builder who I had worked designing his houses. And it wasn't long before I got my contractor's license and my real estate broker's license. And I would buy a piece of land or get an option on it and then develop it, put in utilities and roads and survey it, then sell lots to people on the condition I could design and build their homes. And I was cutting out all these middlemen, but anyway, that was fun for a few years. And I had been drinking through the Army and after the war, and I was functional, but I had to quit that and concentrate on my work, which I just, I didn't read political books. I read, construction manuals and stuff like that. Kind of like Dr. Pierce read mathematics and physics books instead of political books when he got interested in what was going on around him. Anyway, when I bumped heads with the IRS around 1983. They tried to say I owed them tens of thousands of dollars. Well, I didn't. And they sent this negress auditor out, and she more or less accused me of burning my house down to avoid the audit. I said, oh, yeah, okay. So the fight was on. I just said, I'll never work again. Y'all won't get a nickel out of me. And I decided you either have to have a lot of money to fight them or live under the poverty level. And I chose to just live under the poverty level, which didn't bother me that much. And I started looking around at who was fighting the government. I found the White Patriot Party was located about 30 miles from where I lived. And a fellow named Glenn Miller was running that. And he was on the local radio. I listened to him, and I couldn't believe what he was saying, talking about race and the Jews and topics you just don't hear. Funny fella was telling Glenn, says, look, I bleed red just like you. What's your prejudice? And Glenn said, my mule bleeds red too, but he doesn't have the right to vote and sit on juries. Just coming up with stuff like that just tickled me. So I found a way to get in contact with him. Even though he was in the papers and on the radio, even on TV, none of those print or electronic media would give his contact information. They didn't want anybody to get in touch with him.
Surprise.
Yeah. So a fellow named George Dietz up in West Virginia was putting out a lot of publications back then. And I ordered one and asked George to give me Glenn's contact information, and he just put his mailing label on a book I bought, and then I finally made contact with somebody who was fighting the government. Before you knew it, I was talking to him on the phone, and he invited me to come down to his place, and next thing I know, he'd given me a camouflage shirt and a 3x5 Confederate flag on an 11-foot closet rod, and we were marching through these little towns, and it's interesting.
What year was that, Will?
That would have been 85, and I had voted for him in 84. He ran for the Senate in North Carolina, and I voted for him, but it took another year or so before I got tied up in all that IRS mess. And by 86, I had joined Mr. Miller and started meeting a lot of new friends who were racially conscious. And then the government stepped in again and banned us, made us illegal. And I went to the trial, and I got a good close look at how whites just weren't allowed to organize for their interest. And we tried to keep going with a new successor organization, and it went under. And then the Populist Party contacted me. I had been out at the state fair handing out our newspapers, and I've made up a couple of petitions to protect our Second Amendment rights. And it was a gun show. Anyway, I got over 1,100 signatures and people's addresses on that petition. I gave a copy to the governor and a copy to both of our senators. And anyway, that impressed the fellow who was running the Populist Party. He invited me to join with him, and he made me the executive director for North Carolina. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I got to meet many more racially conscious people when we'd go up to D.C. or around to some of these gatherings. And so that's more or less how I got involved in the movement, as they call it, this thing of ours.
Yeah. You mean the thing that doesn't move?
Yeah, the movement that doesn't move, yeah. Actually, it has moved a lot since those days. But I was working with Ed Fields and Willis Carto and David Duke and Tom Metzger and a lot of others that I had met in the White Patriot Party. Not a lot, but a few. And we kept having the Confederate Memorial Day there on the Raleigh Capitol, State Capitol grounds, a beautiful Confederate monument there. And it was Robert E. Lee's and Stonewall Jackson's birthday kind of in the middle of January when they started celebrating Martin Luther King Day. And we just had our own celebration. Did that for a couple of years. And Gary Gallo recognized what I was doing and wanted me to join with him. He was the National Democratic Front. Gary's a very smart fellow. He named me one of his directors. For some reason, I was still cheery, but I was learning. And he was a West Point graduate and Georgetown Law School graduate and went to Europe and studied the National Front, the British Nationalist Party, and the Third Position and all this stuff that was, I wasn't aware of it, but he was on crossfire with Pat Buchanan, and he had a bunch of law clinics around the D.C. area. And anyway, we hit it off quite well, and I was running a little weekly book club there with the remnants of our local White Patriot Party group, and Gary came down to it, and the leader of the group, I wasn't the leader, I just went to it, and he wanted me to read something out of the Bible to the group, and I said, I'm not reading that goddamn shit. And that impressed Gary to no end. He said, you need to be with me. I didn't realize it, but Christianity, I wasn't really a Christian. I'd given that up when I was about 12 years old. But Tom Metzger, I invited him to Raleigh to some gathering there with his son John, and we hit it off. I was doing his cable access show, Race and Reason, on our local cable channel. And boy, I could write a book about that experience, but anyway.
Maybe you should.
Nah, I think I'm through writing books. But Tom said, have you heard of Ben Clausen? I said, no. He said, well, he's there in North Carolina. And this fella, Harold Covington, was in Raleigh, and he put an ad in the Spotlight newspaper using a phony name. And since it was a Raleigh address, I wrote to him, and he revealed himself to me. And he had a lot of background in National Socialism. He'd been around since the early 70s. He gave me a book, Building the Whiter and Brighter World by Ben Clausen. And I read into that book maybe halfway, and I called Tom Metzger and said, that guy Ben Clausen, I'm reading his book. And he said, well, I've got his number. Give him a call. Because it was fascinating to me because Ben Clausen was so anti-Christian and so pro-white. And tying them together, he had founded a new religion, the Church of the Creator. And so I finished reading the book, and I called him up, and he invited me to come up and visit with him. And he more or less hired me on the spot to come work with him. And I said, well, I need to get my affairs in order, but I did want to work with him and pick his brain, learn what I could from him. And I eventually went there with my girlfriend, and we lived in a nice apartment above his church. And he didn't want us living in sin, so he said, y'all need to get married. I said, well, okay. And August 8th, 1988, we got married, and anyway, I worked with him for like 15 months.
You can't forget that date.
Yeah. No, I don't. I haven't forgotten it. I told him I'd give him a year, and I stayed about 15 months. he made me his hosta primus. He had Latin titles. He was the Pontifex Maximus, and I was his hosta primus, which is first spear, more like spear catcher. But I was the editor of his paper, Racial Loyalty, so I had to start writing. I hadn't really written before, and I didn't really have anything to write about, but now I did. And I went back to the woods. I was pretty well burnt out after 15 months. My wife had left me. She couldn't take that kind of intense working at the world headquarters of hate, you know. But we're still friends to this day. I just went to the woods, found me a cabin in the woods. I had been painting portraits, and when I quit working, I started painting. And I got pretty good at it. And I was raising German Shepherd dogs, hiking, reading, just re-energizing myself, doing a lot of reading. I was working some for Wilmot Robertson, Inspiration Magazine, did some covers for him, and a little writing. And I read the book Hunter by William Pierce. I said, good God, this fella. It's like he wrote this book directly to me. And I told my friend Gordon, I said, he was an alliance member. I said, I need to meet this man. And he took off from his job for a vacation, and we drove up to West Virginia and met with Dr. Pierce and stayed like 3 days and just really hit it off. Nobody was there. I couldn't believe nobody was working with this man. His wife was there. That was it. So anyway.
Interesting. But
yeah, he gave
kind of makes sense.
Well, it's a hard job, and we're mostly idealistic volunteers. You know, we're not in it for the money. I had learned so much from Mr. Clausen that I felt like Dr. Pierce was a notch above him. I could see we needed a new religion. Non-Semitic, non-Abrahamic, or whatever, a Middle Eastern religion with, it's Jewish.
Right.
It's a Jewish God, Yahweh or Jehovah or Allah, whatever you want to call it. But it's mythical. It's not suitable for Europeans. We're not Middle Eastern. And I was pretty well set on that by then, and Pierce invited me to come work for him, and he'd given me Which Way Western Man, written by an old Alliance member, William Gailey Simpson. It's a great book, and he gave me Best of Attack and National Vanguard, which was the chronicling of the National Alliance's history going back to around 1970, and some booklets on cosmotheism, which was the philosophy, ideology, or worldview, whatever you want to call it, a religion. I absorbed them, and then he said, you need to be up here working with me. And I've told this before. You need to be here because the Jew and his collaborators still live. I said, oh, my God.
That is perfect.